When it comes to your chosen e-racing platform, iRacing or rFactor 2, just to name a few, there is a subscription, there's that faster car or legendary new track, whatever it is, it all comes at a price. If your goals are a little loftier and you're putting together a race team or running a series, then your costs are multiplied. So what does it cost to go virtual racing? And should I have just gone and bought a real race car instead? Plus, in this week's show, we look at arguably the biggest event in the e-racing calendar, the Le Mans 24 Hour, with YouTube content creator and broadcaster of all things sim racing, Chris Hay. We also pose that not-so-old question, with real racing starting back up, where to for the future of the digital racing from here? Welcome to eRacing X, a podcast dedicated to bringing you some news, information and an insight into what the virtual racing world is all about. Welcome to eRacing X. On the line, I'm joined by Andrew Clark. Great to have you back, Clarky.
Yeah, it's good to be back too. I wasn't sure I was going to make it, but I'm here.
And the other part of our threesome is Nathan Huppert.
No threesomes.
how you going,
Triumvirate.
Nathan? Triumvirate.
Let's call it a trio.
Okay, I'm going to go with Clarky. What did you call us, Clarky?
Triumvirate.
That's it. That's, I'm going with that. Nathan, how are you?
Very good, very good.
Okay, so the biggest thing happening this week, I would say, was the Le Mans 24 Hour. Last week, though, the supercars wrapped up their E-Series. Also joining us today will be a special guest, a gentleman from the UK, Chris Hay, and he will be also getting more in-depth into us a little bit about the Le Mans 24 Hour that was held on the weekend. But first of all, Clarky, what have you been up to? You been on the sim at all? I know you're not feeling too well. Have you been...
No, honestly, I've got the pedals at my feet and I'm touching them with my feet at the moment, and that's about all I've done for the last 4 weeks. So,
did you get any viewing in... Did you watch any esports?
No, the only thing I watched was bits of the 24-hour of Le Mans virtual. Obviously, it's a bit hard to watch the whole thing. So I watched it in patches and I certainly looked at the highlights package that they put together. And, you know, it's interesting because probably like most people, I mean, I immediately jumped on and joined the iRacing platform. Didn't even know that this, you know, what is it, eRacing 2? Is that what it's called? rFactor 2. I didn't even realise that existed, for instance. So to see it coming into play, you know, via various aspects, I think that's what the Formula E bike guys used as well. So... it's a bit of an eye-opener in that sense as well, and seems to be a couple of loyalties being tested through it as well.
It's interesting you talk about rFactor 2 and all that kind of stuff. We'll get into a little bit of that. We're going to talk about pricing and the cost to join these types of platforms. Nathan, have you caught up with any racing, done any racing yourself over the weekend?
Yeah, I did a little bit. We did the first round of the AMF GT Championship on Sunday night at Silverstone. Had a great team result with a second, a fourth and a tenth. So we're leading the team's championship after the first round, which was good. But otherwise, apart from that, I caught up with watching a bit of the 24-hour event from Le Mans, which we can talk about, and the supercars finale last week, which was also pretty good.
What do you think of the supercars finale?
Supercars was a really good event. I enjoyed watching it. The racing was really solid. I think we've seen just a huge improvement since the first round of the series. But yeah, like we were talking about in last week's podcast, it'll be interesting to see whether an E-Series is continued to be adopted by supercars and all the drivers. I did notice that Rick Kelly put his rig up for sale pretty much the minute the event finished. So there were probably some drivers who are not so keen to continue, but I, for one, would love to see something like that continue.
Well, this is the thing. It's a big question everybody's asking with the sport now starting to get up and going in the real sense. What is the place for the e-racing or the e-series? Personally, I hope they keep doing it. But I also need some named drivers competing in it to keep that interest level up, I reckon.
Interestingly though, Nev, if we go back to this thing, there's been a big call for people to try and mix sim racing with the real racing in the future. Because you know, people have enjoyed it is the bottom line, and it's accessible. We know that the drivers are out there playing around on their sims in between races, or most of the young drivers are anyway. So, like, huge call to just say, you know, let's find a way to embed this in the supercar season in particular. And I'm just having a look for the results. But Big Cafe ran a poll on it. And I think last thing I looked, it was like 80% up.
Actually, I just brought the poll up now, and they've had nearly 6,000 votes. So I think that's a pretty good sample size. And yeses are 56%, noes are 39%, and unsure is 4%. So
what's the actual poll for?
Whether we should blend a supercars season with an E-Series at the same time.
Okay, so the figures again?
56% yes, 39% no, and the remainder 4% unsure.
Well, the supercars actually believe, they've got the stats in that. They reckon they got to 500,000 new viewers, people that haven't watched the sport before. That's a pretty significant numbers.
Yeah, see, and I look at it from a marketing exercise because, as you know, like, I'm not just a writer, I'm also a marketing person. And I think one of the obstacles facing the growth of all sport is how do you engage the youth of today? So they reckon one of the reasons why soccer is growing globally is because of the FIFA World Soccer game on the computers, that it's such a good game that people really get into it and enjoy it, and the uptake's been huge. Same thing here with supercars and with car racing in general. So I think we can say, you know, we can go out and we can hit that younger generation. We can hit the 10 to 18-year-olds who love playing with things online and love doing things online and really engage them and draw them in, and then build this magnificent world of real racing and sim racing as a combination. And I think if whatever class of car racing does that first is going to enjoy monstrous and massive benefits.
Yes. Well, it's all how they've engaged these new potential fans. How do they keep them? What do you do to keep them coming back?
You have to keep doing it.
Yes, but there's also a magic there that I think they struck on with the series. And what is that magic? They're all trying to figure out what the secret ingredient is. I think it's a number of things. Partly it's the production quality, which I think supercars have got. Have all your drivers involved, which pretty much supercars had. They're two key ingredients. If you can't have all your drivers, at least have a fair number of them, and you've got to have some star name drivers.
But I think also the Formula E package was the one to me that was the best, when they had the sim racers running their own race, the real Formula E racers in their own race as well. And the two of them ran side by side on the same day. But the prize was for the person who ended up winning the simulator side of the world was to go in and join the big boys as well. And ultimately, I think the sim racers are probably better at sim racing than the real racers are anyway. But I just thought it was a brilliant combination of the two, to have the combination of saying, you're a sim racing fan, come and race a Formula E with us while the serious boys are racing the Formula E.
I think you're right, Clark. I think there's no doubt that the product itself can be made really well. We've shown that over the last 6 months with supercars, IndyCars, Formula E. The production and the entertainment and the quality of racing can be really good, but it's a matter of time, and it's a matter of sponsors being able to get their head around the idea that there is value in, tipping some money in to make these series happen. Because at the end of the day, Shane Van Gisbergen took out the Supercars Championship last week. How much does that trophy mean to him? It may not mean a lot this year. Maybe in 2 or 3 years' time, that E-Series trophy, when it could be, filled with $100,000, $200,000 worth of prize money, then that could mean, a hell of a lot.
But imagine if they got to the point where they do what Le Mans did, and we actually have a full Bathurst 1000 for them. So, rather than the way we're doing it now in the little bits and pieces, but like getting really serious about it. I just think what I've learned from the last few months is that we must embrace the sim racing world if we want to grow the real racing world.
Well, I like the idea with Bathurst, and even though I need to move this conversation on, I will say that I think a Bathurst is definitely on the cards, but I think it's something that the world needs. It needs to grow there naturally. I mean, if you had a full-on Bathurst, it may not be as successful as if you had some smaller ones and then gradually grew it there. Because even Bathurst didn't start out to be that long at the start. You're listening to E-Racing X. And I want to talk about costs involved associated with gaming. And now we all know, we've all had these stories about sim rig costs and stuff like that, but there's more to just buying a sim rig. You could have the best sim rig in the world, but you still got to subscribe to iRacing and stuff like that. So I wanted to go into a little bit about associated costs of just being involved in the sport. And Clarkie, I'll start with you. When you got your wheels and pedals, you had to subscribe and you chose iRacing. What are the kind of costs as a general basic package to get involved in iRacing?
Well, the beauty at the moment was that they were doing discounts, so it's a bit cheaper than normal. But it seems like it's about $100 a year, $500 for the pedal and the wheel. I haven't got a rig or anything like that. But the interesting thing for me was going out and looking to buy a rig, and everybody's out of stock. Like, it was such a rush on it that no one had anything left. So, you know, my normal supplier of IT stuff sells them, but they didn't have any. And they said, oh, it might be 6 months or so. So, yeah, I'd love to get the rig. I'm going to buy a new TV for the lounge room. So the TV from the lounge room is going to become the TV for the rig. But, you know, it's just about waiting until stock's back and life's back to normal. But they aren't as expensive as you think. You know, like, some of them are only like $400 or $500 just to have one. But obviously it doesn't have motion or anything. It just has the setup for you to sit in the seat and do all of the things normally. So it's not that expensive, is the bottom line, until you get serious like Nathan.
Is there anything else there that you would either upgrade or buy?
No, I mean, the interesting thing is people talk about computers and the power of the computers. I mean, I've obviously got a computer that's set up for graphic design work, and it copes fine. Like, I don't have any real glitching or anything along those lines. So my computer seems to do the job. So I'm not thinking I need a new and dedicated computer for the job with one of those keyboards that changes color every few seconds. So I think I'm all right on that side of it. For me, it was really just saying, well, if I do set it up, you know, what do I put in front of me? So the screen. And I've looked around a little bit, and obviously the ideal setup is to have the three screens, but I wouldn't go to that extent to start with. So as I say, I'm going to have a redundant 50-inch TV, and that will be my start point, I think, just hooked up to my standard computer. And eventually, I think, having listened to the podcast that you did a couple of weeks ago with Byron, I might need a new pedal set. But I've engaged an engineer in that process, and his business has just had to close down. So I said, well, here's a new job for you. You know, I know you make pedal boxes for race cars, so how about you build pedal boxes for sim races and build me one? So he's starting to have a look at how you do all of that part of it. So we'll see what goes through from there.
I want to talk about the subscription to iRacing. Nathan, well, let's talk about the different platforms and some of the pricing. Let's start with iRacing. This $100 a year or whatever, what does it get you?
So, yeah, I think at the moment, for any new subscribers, they tend to do a special, like Clarkie was suggesting. So it's about $55 a year, which is about $80-odd Australian. And that gets you, you can use the platform 24 hours a day as much as you want. There is a bunch of series you can race in, I think over 40. There you get about 13 or 14 cars and 19 tracks. Now, all the cars and tracks, as we've talked about before, are laser scanned, very accurate. And you get access to do all the iRacing special events like their own Le Mans 24 hours and so on. So above and beyond that, if you want to buy some extra tracks or extra cars and compete in some different series that run different tracks, then you have to purchase that car or that track.
You're predominantly on the iRacing platform. Do you use any other of the? Do you race any other platforms? And if you do, what does it cost?
Most of my driving is on iRacing. That's where I choose to compete. The competitive nature in the league and official races in that platform, I think, is really solid and a little bit of what sets it apart at the moment. We talked about cost before for, you know, about $80 a year for a subscription to it. Extra cars and tracks. I think tracks are $14.95 and cars are $11 or $12.95. They're $11.95. So over time, as you want to buy more content, the costs do add up a bit. But I look at it from a point of view of how many hours do I spend and how much entertainment do I get from this service, and it's a huge amount of value. As far as other platforms go, yeah, I do have Assetto Corsa, which has a wider variety of tracks and cars. Assetto Corsa Competizione, which is their GT3 specific product. I've got that as well. So that's pretty good for GT3 racing. It has some different physics involved in that. And I also, I used to use R Factor, the original R Factor, when it came out. That's what I first started racing on, which at that time was just a one-off purchase cost. And R Factor 2, I don't own, but I've been thinking about getting that just because it's really developed to a point now, like we saw in the Le Mans race, where there's good physics, there's great content available, and there's some pretty solid racing in it as well. And that's a one-off purchase. I think it's about $45 Australian to buy R Factor 2. And there's also other content packs. You can buy tracks for and cars, you know, $8, $10, that sort of thing. So you obviously get some free content when you buy the game, like iRacing. But if you want to get other specific content, you can purchase that.
iRacing, let's concentrate on that one because it's the one you know best. You can't race every track. If you join it,
You start off, the license system restricts that a little bit as well in their official series. So you get a certain number of free tracks when you subscribe, and you're always, there's a mix of road and oval tracks and a mix of road and oval cars. So if you want to do the Nordschleife, you know, Nürburgring in a GTE, you know, Porsche, you need to buy the Porsche and buy that track. And once you've purchased that track, as long as you have an active subscription, you can drive that track in practice or racing or whenever you like.
Okay. Well, I wanted to get into the team aspect, the costs of the racing. Fusion Sim Racing, you're a team, right? And you guys are always actively looking for sponsorship. What are the associated costs to run a team?
Yeah, it's a good question, Nev. Every team, as you know, is always looking for sponsors all the time. And we're lucky we do have a number of great sponsors.
Give them a plug.
Our sponsors at the moment are Dripping Paint Graphics, Daryl Carter Plastering, and Eclipse Signage. They're our key sponsors, and we're bringing on two more in July, so we'll announce them early July. That sponsorship value really goes towards covering costs like hosting of sessions. So we pay to host our own test sessions. Some of that money might go towards driver development. You know, if we have a pool of funds available and we need to enter a series which charges entry fees, and if we have, you know, four or five committed drivers to a series, then the team may be able to pay the entry fees for the drivers. We could also use funding to run our own race series, you know, with some sponsor support, because broadcasting a series, you know, will cost money. You need to cover the broadcast costs. So there's a number of different ways you can use sponsorship dollars.
So you're saying it costs money to broadcast it. Don't you just broadcast it on Twitch or something?
You can stream it yourself, but obviously if you wanted to host your own series, for example, so, you know, the Fusion team, we're looking at hosting a new type of racing series in 2021. We will be wanting to broadcast that with commentary on YouTube, so live commentary, all the overlays, that sort of thing. And, yeah, you need to pay for that that service. So, you know, that's when we would call in some of our sponsors and say, hey, look, we're looking to run a series. You can get some more exposure. Are you interested in doing that? So that's where sponsorship money tends to get used in covering those broadcast costs and also helping just with running costs of the team. So none of us are paid drivers. We don't earn an income from racing. I won a $100 voucher in a competition last year, but, you know, vouchers only worth it if you want to buy something. So, we just try to cover our costs, really.
You say it costs to run series. What does it actually cost?
I think a broadcast, look, they probably range a bit based on who you go to do the broadcast, but they're probably in the range of sort of $20 to $40 an hour of broadcasting time, something in that sort of range, I guess.
So you've got to pay by the hour?
It's usually by the hour, and you'd have an agreement to say, look, we're going to run this series every Sunday night for the next 12 weeks. Here's a time slot. You get the broadcaster to commit to the time. They would give you a quote for the cost to run that series if you're an event organiser, and away you go.
So you'd buy like a 2-hour window gap or whatever, however long it take to run your race, and you'd run it within that window of time.
That's typically how it works. And in the past, you know, the Fusion, we've run an event called the Australian Endurance Championship. That was a couple of years ago. So that's the process you have to go through. For the last few years, we haven't run our own series. We've just raced in other series around the place that mostly don't have an entry fee, but occasionally there is a small entry fee involved.
So what's an entry fee to a series starting out and all round about?
Oh, it could be small. It could be anything from $5 to $20, something like that. So it's usually, you know, that funding would go towards broadcast costs as well, and also to make sure that drivers are committed to that series. So
I got it. What about when you're in the bigger series? What does it cost to enter in those?
You mean the professional sort of series, the world championships?
Yeah, why not? The top guys.
Look, I don't think there's an entry fee. I think it's more of a qualification. So you have to qualify through by winning races and showing talent. So that's the way they tend to work.
Do you have to pay an entry fee for Aussie Mix and Fix Series?
No. So they've got sponsors that cover the cost of the broadcasting, but there's no prize money involved for the series. So all the drivers are in there because it's super competitive. So at Silverstone last week, there was over 110 drivers that entered the racing that night. So after qualifying, there was three different servers running, split one, split two, split three. So it's a very competitive series. And that's why I race it, and that's why the Fusion team race it. It's good quality racing.
Clarky, you're on the iRacing platform. Are you just going to stick to the iRacing platform?
No, well, I think finance always comes into it, and you don't just want to keep on throwing money at things. So I'll probably stick with iRacing for a little while, unless this business takes off that we're doing here. Maybe I'll go out and get everything, because we just need to know everything. But the problem is always time. You know, you learn the intricacies of something, and I noticed during the Le Mans 24-hour, you know, that Max Verstappen's getting stuck into R Factor 2. But I think everything's got its quirks, everything's got its differences. You learn something and that becomes your familiarity. So I think changing from one to the other might not be as easy as you think, in a sense. And at the end of the day, you know, I'm not that serious that I've got to go chasing something. So my gut feel is that I'll stick iRacing.
You're listening to eRacing X.
Okay, so I just want to talk about the Le Mans 24-hour, the virtual Le Mans 24-hour. Clarky, you reckon this is significant because, well, it was held on the same day as the actual race was going to be held on.
Yeah, I mean, Le Mans 24-hour is one of the biggest motor races in the world. It's certainly on my bucket list, and I'll get there eventually. But when they couldn't do the real race, they decided to do this. So they've jumped in with the R Factor 2 guys, primarily because R Factor 2 has the card. So there's not a lot of the LMP cars on iRacing. So the only way they could do it was on this particular platform. But I think people were calling it the biggest race in sim racing history simply because it was changing that. It had all the full backing of the ACO, which are the organisers of the race. You know, it had the drivers and the teams and the broadcasters were there. You know, Tom Christensen, Alec McNish were in it talking about things. There were full works driver lineups, you know, so the whole thing. So as they would have turned up on that particular weekend, they turned up for the race. And the funny thing I thought was that Pagano actually had practiced changing rigs in the middle of the race. And then, of course, his rig broke. And so there's all this footage of him getting out there and changing his rig in 20 seconds, you know, so less time than it takes to change tyres and fuel, which I thought was quite amazing. Overall, I thought it was really good. I mean, I got to watch bits of it. I watched the highlights package and all that sort of stuff. The names was what blew me away. I mean, you're talking, you know, Button, Buemi, Hartley, Van Dorn, Conway, Kobayashi, Alonso, Barrichello, Panis, Max Verstappen driving with Lando Norris, Andy Prio, Nelson Piquet Jr., Montoya, Fisher Keller, Massa, Pagano, Catherine Legg, the inaugural W Series champion, Lotterer, Leclerc, Giovinazzi. Like, the list was staggering. To get people involved like that, I think, was just amazing.
Yeah, I agree. And the effort that the teams put in, especially because this didn't have fixed setups, so the teams could do their own engineering and work on car setups leading up to the race. So I was watching the coverage and they cut to the Ferrari team and they had engineers there, people looking at data, the drivers. I mean, it was like a proper race. They were in a race garage, it looked like. So I thought it was a landmark event just because of the contribution that the teams made with engineers and strategy and car setup. So from that point of view, it was a huge sim racing event.
Yeah, and as you say, like the Aston Martin team, like they showed them, they had a bank of engineers sitting there on their computers engineering the cars for these guys. So it was serious stuff, you know. So it was next level.
Just to get this right, for the untrained person, this actually went for 24 hours, right? Now, I know they had a couple of server issues, or we'll call them red flags, right? Because that's how they viewed it.
The red flags, I mean, how many laps are spent under yellow flag at Le Mans 24-hour anyway? So it wasn't a huge issue in that sense, having the server crashes. People always look to complain about something, but, you know, it wasn't a big issue. I suppose could have given some of the guys a chance to go to the toilet or something, but, you know, not a huge issue in that sense, I didn't think. What was sensational about this race, I thought, was the final stint when you had four cars all in contention for the race and Jurnai Simoncic, who I'm pretty sure was the bloke who won the McLaren Sim Trial last year. His last stint was outrageous. He was just driving, he was passing. You could see him setting them up. So, and because what I love about car racing is when you can see the guys thinking, what am I going to do next? And you can see him pulling out and sticking his nose in, and he's lining the guy up for the pass and working out how to pass him in a similar car. And his last stint was amazing. He went from fourth to second, and he finished 17 seconds back on the leader. But I don't think it would have taken many more laps for him to have got up to him. And, you know, so to watch somebody in that kind of touch, in that kind of form, whether they're in sim racing or real racing, I think he's just amazing. And I really enjoyed those closing laps of the race because of that.
Skill is still skill no matter where it is.
Just echo what Andrew said with the strategy and the effort for 24 hours. Okay. You know, Fusion Sim Racing and other teams on iRacing do that in special events, and we try to put in a similar amount of effort to have strategy and someone looking at data and work on setups. And it's great to see that taken to the next level by all the pros.
Well, here's another thing. There's another Le Mans 24 hour that you guys are involved in. When is that on?
Yeah, iRacing's holding its own 24 hour event. And I think actually the trademark owner of Le Mans doesn't want other platforms to use the Le Mans name. So there's been some pressure for iRacing to change it to the 24-hour race in the French countryside. But that runs. We've been busy working and setups and testing, putting our team schedules together and sorting out cars and who's driving when. And we're due to kick off midnight on Saturday night.
You're listening to eRacing X.
On the line, joining us, Chris Hay from sunny London. Chris, we've got you.
It is sunny for once, yeah.
We've got you here to talk about the Le Mans virtual 24-hour race that happened on the weekends. But first, you've been around e-racing for a long time. Could you give me a quick background of where you come from and your e-racing experience?
Yeah, sure. First of all, great to be here. Thank you for having me on the show. It is a little earlier than the usual podcast recording for me, but we can work with that. My first introduction to what I guess would become sim racing was Jeff Crammond's first Grand Prix game back in the early 1990s. It was the height of Mansell Mania, and my dad bought the only racing Formula One game for the PC he had at the time. And at 8 years old, I was hooked, as any eight-year-old would be. And I've played every driving title since then. And obviously, sim racing became more and more serious, perhaps for want of a better word, as time progressed, but the quality of simulation certainly improved. And I've just become more and more immersed in this world to the point where 4 or 5 years ago, I decided to start a YouTube channel where perhaps I would try and focus on maybe a more journalistic side of things, taking an editorial stance on equipment issues, hardware, and stuff within the sims themselves, rather than necessarily just driving the car like you might see from some other content creators. I mean, it's very tempting to just get in the car and drive because, well, that's the fun bit.
It's interesting you say all of that, because I'm just looking at an old video of a Jeff Crammond Formula One Grand Prix One game, and it's very blocky. It's a bit like a Minecraft thing, isn't it? So, I mean, the graphics is something that's just come along so beautifully with car racing simulation, isn't it?
Oh, very, very much so. But it's not just the graphics. I mean, back then, there were, certainly to start with, there wasn't any dedicated hardware. So you were playing it, if you were lucky, you had a joystick, but you might even be playing it on the keyboard. So the controls would be blocky as well as the visuals.
Well, Chris, you were really impressed with the Le Mans 24 hour, because you don't normally do a race review. You normally, like you said, you do reviews on products and other stuff. What compelled you to want to talk about the Le Mans and do that review?
Well, there were a couple of things, really. As you're right in saying that I don't really generally talk about specific races, but I think this was an important one for two reasons. First of all, it was the biggest sim race ever, probably in terms of audience and in terms of the buy-in from real-world manufacturers, from the real-world organizer, ACO, and the drivers themselves as well. But we've had this interesting time period during the COVID lockdown where things have progressed from a position where I don't think the real-world motorsport guys really knew how to use sim racing to start with. Some of them took like a duck to water, but others were really dragging their heels, and you felt like they were doing it because they had commitments to sponsors, or you know, the team manager trod on their hand until they eventually complied. So you've got this situation where you had some guys who were taking it really seriously, other guys who weren't. And by the time we got to the virtual Le Mans, it was really obvious that every single part of that whole ecosystem was taking it 100% seriously, from the drivers, the teams, the organizers, the stewards, the broadcast staff. They even had the same caterer that they use at normal World Endurance Championship events in the studio with them. So it was every single part of it was done at an extraordinarily high level. And yeah, I felt the need to talk about that.
The driver lineup was stellar, wasn't it? I mean, who would have thought we'd ever see Max Verstappen and Lando Norris sharing the same car for a start? But even the fact that, you know, the Toyota team brought the full factory lineup and the whole deal. I mean, that's what kind of what blew me away about it, was that, yeah, it was really serious. They weren't dicking around. They weren't, you know, playing tiddlywinks or your old Jeff Cramer F1 game. Like, they were getting serious about this. And then to look at the Aston Martin team with all of their engineers sitting or huddled on computers, setting up cars. I mean, it was staggering.
Yeah, I think the Aston Martin team's an interesting case. I did mention it in the video there. They're about 50 miles up the road from me in Banbury. And they took over one of the drivers, Darren Turner, runs a performance simulation business. So they've got a series of race sims designed for racing teams to use, you know, the kind that take up a whole room rather than just the corner of your office like ours do or whatever. So they were running their cars out of the dedicated Aston Martin sim that they have in there, the dedicated GT sim, which is very cool. I mean, you know, for someone like me who's into all sorts of types of simulation, that is, you know, that's as good as it gets, really. But they also had the team over at ProDrive doing race engineering with all the data and the computers, trying to, you know, work out the strategy for the race and everything else, and monitoring the cars. And I think that's a level of commitment we've not seen before. Toyota's another great example where, amongst a lot of other teams, it has to be said, but Toyota in particular is sort of the big team in the World Endurance Championship and Le Mans at the moment, running both of their full driver lineups plus one sim driver. And I think the sim drivers were quite important to all of those teams to get them up to speed. You know, speaking to Yuri Kasdorp, who was in the number 8 Toyota, about the preparation for this, you know, he was preparing for the Virtual Endurance Championship Le Mans race the previous week, but he was saying, you know, all of the time had gone into the Le Mans Virtual, the big race, not because the race was any different. They both run on R-Factor 2, they're both 24 hours long, they're both in the same car, so it's a, you know, it's a reasonably similar approach. But, you know, he had 6 Toyota racing drivers that needed to go from, you know, 5% knowledge on R-Factor 2 to being able to represent, you know, one of the largest automotive brands in the world with a huge amount of racing prestige at the biggest sim race ever. So, you know, I think there's a lot of, you know, young sim racing guys who've had to shoulder quite a serious responsibility over the last few weeks. And I think they've acquitted themselves amazingly.
Were you surprised how serious everybody took this event?
I'm not sure surprised is the right word. I thought there would be perhaps a few more people that treated it as just a bit of fun. As I referenced earlier, we've had people that have been quite slow to really adapt the idea that, you know, for this few months at least, sim racing is going to be the serious thing that they have to do as their jobs, particularly on the driver's side of things. But, you know, I think without exception, everyone was really, really engaged in building this thing. Everyone was working towards the same sort of creative vision. They wanted to create a replacement for Le Mans, which would have happened last weekend. Couldn't happen. Should be running in September. We'll see. I mean, I don't think anyone knows what's going on in Europe at the moment, least of all anyone in Europe. So, you know, it's just one of those situations where it was this beautiful moment where lots of people came together, hundreds of people came together, all with the same vision in mind. And, you know, by and large, I think they all managed to achieve it, which is always a beautiful thing.
We were talking a little bit earlier about the combination of sim racing and real racing and how they can probably marry together in the new world. I mean, I think one of the things that's going to come out of this COVID-19 crisis is that people are exploring ways to do that now. And, you know, the quality of what's gone on, the quality of the racing from this, from down here in Australia, like we've had, you know, the supercars have had every single driver in the series running in the championship. You know,
I just have to jump in. I'm going to interrupt you and just praise the V8 supercar series in iRacing. That's, we've been watching a lot of it over here in our sort of cohort. in the UK, and it's been fantastic. There's been a few interesting moments. There's a couple of big pileups, but yeah, that many drivers new to something, into a place, and they all want to win. That's the thing. They all want to win. You can see the competitive edge is there in the Sims, and you know, the Aussie V8 series was one of the early ones that got it right. I thought, at least.
Yeah. So have you put any thought into whether you think the two of them can marry together, the simulator world and the real world, and what we can maybe look at going forwards, or are they still going to remain disparate objects?
Well, it's probably the future of this whole thing. So that's probably what I get to. Where do you see the future of this game?
Well, yeah, this is it. This is a path that a lot of people have been on for a very, very long time. It's been very slow progress. We've seen some racing drivers have started over the last two or three years to bring sim racing into their sort of daily prep, into their marketing efforts as well. So you look at drivers like, particularly GT drivers like Nicky Team and David Perrell, both Blancpain GT drivers and World Endurance Championship drivers, who have seen that, hey, you know, I can use this to help build my brand. I can use this to help keep sharp. And, you know, this is another string to the bow. The worlds have gotten close enough that this is worth doing. And we've also seen over the last couple of years that car manufacturers have gotten really serious about it. Really, you know, in terms of, you know, 4 or 5 years ago, we didn't really have a Porsche, for example, in any racing game. It was always Rough, the tuning brand. You know, that's how they get around having a Porsche 911 in your racing game. And then all of a sudden, someone at Porsche worked out, hey, the kids that were playing Gran Turismo in 1997 are now out there buying cars. If our Porsche wasn't in it, why are they all buying old Skylines? They should be buying our Porsche. Or, you know. I know it's a controversial thing to say, especially in Oz as well. You know, the thing, you know, Porsche, you know, if you're a kid, you know, if you're a guy in your 20s with money, you should be aspiring to buy a Porsche, really. And they weren't, because everyone's got this nostalgia for the racing games they were growing up with and the brands associated with it. And, you know, Nissan were easily the brand that got that earliest. You know, they were working on that in the 90s. They understood that. They were running in the late 90s and early 2000s the driver program to get real drivers sim drivers into real racing as well. They're miles ahead of the curve.
And it's interesting, isn't it, when you talk about that sort of stuff, that you know, we get a passion for something from there. I mean, I do the Real Racing 3 on my telephone when I'm bored. You know, I pick and choose what cars I want to try and win. You know, I'm out there trying to win the McLaren, but I really couldn't care about winning a Ferrari, for instance. You know, so we've got that passion, and it does grow it, and it builds it all. And the great thing about it is that it's doing it for next to nothing. Like, it doesn't cost much money to go out and have a crack at a Porsche on a race simulator compared to going out onto the road and forking out 200 grand.
Yeah, I mean, that's absolutely why I'm involved in sim racing, is that it just costs so much to go. Even driving in real life is expensive. You know, owning a car is an expensive process, whatever way you look at it. The insurance, the cost of upkeep, the buying the vehicle itself, that's not a cheap thing. Driving a racing car, on the other hand, is orders of magnitude worse. I get comments on YouTube quite a lot of the time. They see that I've got a reasonably expensive setup that I've spent maybe a few thousand pounds on over the years building it up. And they say, well, you could have gone racing for that. I'm like, yeah, once in an old MX-5 that I borrowed from. Yeah, I could go once. And that's the thing, you know, it's quite easy to look at, you know, something like an MX-5 cup car. You know, you get an old Mark II or Mark III MX-5, pick it up for a couple of grand because there's loads of them. And they think, well, that's all you need. Strap on a helmet and off you go. And it's not even close. Like, the car's the
It doesn't work, does it? I used to have an old, my last race car was an old Porsche, and I could get 150Ks out of a tank of fuel. And the tyres cost $1,000 each and lasted 3,000 kilometres each.
Yeah.
So anybody who thinks that you're going to match this sim racing world on the track is just kidding themselves.
Yeah, a couple of track days maybe.
So what impressed me a lot about this Le Mans 24 Hour was Jurnej Szymanczyk run at the end of the thing. And in terms of, we're talking, you know, like, you're talking, one point you're saying it's all about the cars and inspiring people, but you could watch him starting to set the guys up and work out how he was going to pass them. He was lining them up. He was poking his nose out there. I thought it was a beautiful exhibition of racecraft over that 10-lap period when he went from fourth to second. And I think in no matter of time, he would have been leading the race.
Yeah, I think if strategy had played out a little bit better for them at the end, they could have been very much in contention. Well, they were in contention for the lead. I think one lap of fuel either way, and they would have been right on the button at the last moment. And that's the beauty of Le Mans. Sometimes the race can be wrapped up at hour 12. Particularly when, you know, in the last couple of years with Toyota, it's really just been a question of which Toyota is going to win. But we have races where you don't know who's going to win going into the final laps because of strategy, because of whatever. And the reality is, after 24 hours of racing, to have something that close and that tense is a beautiful thing. Simoncic, as you say, had some excellent racecraft, including what I think was the move of the race round the outside of the Porsche curves.
It's mind-blowing, wasn't it?
Yeah, no, I mean... That was a do-or-die move. He didn't want to finish third at the Le Mans Virtual. He wanted to go on and win. And that's the racer's mindset. But that's something about sim racing, is that these guys do thousands and thousands and thousands of kilometers. They can get in the sim rig at 9 o'clock in the morning and get out at 9 o'clock at night every day. A real racing driver can't do that. These guys can be in a competitive race every night of the week. So the racecraft amongst the high-end esports racers, at least, it's certainly not represented of the rest of sim racing and your average casual lobby that you might join on whatever game. But the esports races, the top, their racecraft is extraordinary. Every driver competing at the top level is just inch perfect all the time. And that's given, I think that's given a few of the real world racers something to worry about a little bit in over recent times.
Well, time is marching on. I'm going to wrap this up, but I've got one more question for you, Chris. What equipment do you have?
Well, I've been very lucky in the sense that I've been involved in this hobby for long enough and been able to build a little bit of a business out of it as well. So I've got some quite nice equipment and a couple of bits that people have even sent me and I've not had to pay for. So I appreciate it. I'm very lucky, and I'm going to caveat that to start with. I'm running a Simlabs Evo rig, which is an aluminium extrusion rig, which is very customizable, which I like because I like buying new gear and changing the rig around and finding new ways to run things. And it's also incredibly stiff, which is important because I've got a direct drive wheel. I've gone through a couple of direct drive systems, currently running the Fanatec DD2 because it can run on both PlayStation and PC. I'm primarily a PC-based sim racer, but with a couple of major titles coming out on PlayStation over the next few months, I thought, well, I should probably get back into that side of things again. It was something I did a few years ago, but I've been stuck on the PC for a while. And I've got just a bunch of different wheels for that. And in terms of VR and things like that, I was running the Oculus Rift for a long time, which I really, really enjoyed. The only problem is it gets in the way of video making a little bit. It's, as a user experience, it's 10 out of 10. And I would only ever race in VR going forward.
So you race the goggles on?
For a very long time, just because of the immersiveness. The first time you slip on that headset and you go into particularly a single-seater car, and you turn into a corner and you look down and you can see the wheel just going over the apex of the corner for the first time ever in a racing sim. It's not just a wheel in your face. You can actually see around and look into the apex of the corner. So that's a beautiful thing. But a lot of sim racers use things like track IR as well to be able to look around and be able to get that sense of perspective. I'm not a huge fan. Again, it gets in the way of the video editing.
So what pedal box do you have?
I'm running the Fanatec Club Sport V3s at the moment. I've got the performance brake kit in it, which you can add a whole load of extra resistance. So I've got it set to about 70 kilos of resistance, which is very nice.
And one other thing, some people actually forget to mention this, but I think it's important. What brand of seat do you have?
I'm using, it's a Sparco. I think it's the R100 or R200. It's a sports seat, so it's designed to go in a sports car rather than being a full bucket seat, because I've got quite a small room here. And being able to jump in, like having a bit of access at the side rather than having the big headrest coming forward, is useful. Also, I have to get cameras in around the rig and stuff.
And you don't need you don't need side impact support.
You're unlikely to fall out of your seat in a racing sim. It's not happened to me yet.
Clearly you don't have a wife to walk in the room and hit you.
I do, but our baby is 15 weeks old, so I can hear her coming.
Ah, excellent.
Chris, I appreciate your time on the show today. I'd like to thank you, and I'd like to obviously invite you back to maybe talk to us in the future.
Thank you, man. It's been a pleasure. It's always great talking about sim racing. It's much easier to get me started than it is to stop. So thank you very much, guys.
E-Racing X has been brought to you by Motorsport 360, the app, and is produced by Big Hair Productions. You've been listening to Andrew Clark, Nathan Huppets, and Neville Wilkinson. We would also like to thank Chris Hay for his time on the show today. The song you're listening to is Driverless Cars by Dave Butt, with all other production and sound design by yours truly. You can get E-Racing X from most good podcast destinations, including Anchor, Spotify, and of course iTunes. For extended interviews, stories, and all other extras, you can view and listen at our website, eracingx.com. As always, thanks for listening and take care of yourselves.